It's also important to help people stay focused on your organization's overall mission and superordinate goals. This allows people to coalesce around the big picture issues of taking care of your customers, delivering great products and services, and creating value for your enterprise. Next, make it okay for people to have and express legitimate differences of opinion, especially when discussing substantive issues in your workplace. Encourage people to be open and candid when they're talking about setting goals, developing plans, improving processes, solving problems, or any issue that is important to your organization's success. Patrick Lencioni, author of The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, describes a phenomenon that he calls artificial harmony. It's a fake kind of agreement in which real problems are swept under the rug, only to reemerge and cause bigger trouble at a later point in time. Effective leaders and team members need to look for ways to generate honest discussions around substantive issues. But people need to know that it's not okay to dominate discussions, openly disrespect or discount the input of others, or bully other people when attempting to find an optimal solution to a real issue. You also need to work hard to know, understand, and address the problems that confront your work group because of organizational policies, procedures, and practices. In many organizations, ineffective and outdated modes of operation can create real difficulty for people trying to get their work done. These difficulties can easily translate into conflicts, so it's really important to address these issues to the extent that it's humanly possible. You'll find it's easier to resolve these issues if you solicit everyone's input on how to deal with them. Then, train yourself and the people you work with to develop great problem-solving and conflict resolution skills. It's very useful when members of a work group or team have an agreed-upon problem-solving process and conflict resolution model that they can all use when needed. Having these skills and tools in place can prevent conflict or help resolve it more quickly when it does occur. I'll share a helpful conflict resolution model with you in just a minute. But keep in mind that having a plan to deal with conflict means nothing if you don't take action. Conflicts can easily multiply if left unchecked. Waiting and hoping for a conflict to resolve itself is wishful thinking and a recipe for bigger problems ahead. And remember that emotional conflicts can bring out the very worst in people. So do not lose sight of people's feelings as you work to identify the specific causes of conflict that you're trying to resolve. Finally, it's critically important to know yourself and how you handle and work through the process of resolving conflict. Do you know your strengths and weaknesses in handling workplace conflict? Do you know and understand how your actions can impact others when resolving conflict? Do you know your preferred style of resolving conflict? You need that kind of self-awareness if you're going to successfully turn your workplace disagreements into positive outcomes. To help gauge your abilities, I'd like to turn to one of the best-known assessments for measuring a person's conflict resolution style. Since 1974, the Thomas Kilman Conflict Resolution Model has helped many people understand the various strategies that can be used to resolve conflict. Whether they're parties to a conflict themselves or observers trying to resolve a conflict among others. Developed by management professors Kenneth Thomas and Ralph Kilman, the model focuses on the interaction of two critical behaviors, assertiveness and cooperation. And these behaviors are, in fact, the cornerstone of understanding conflict resolution. Assertiveness can be described as the strength of a person's desire to satisfy her own concerns and needs in pursuing a desired outcome. So a person might be very assertive and even aggressive in pursuing a desired outcome that she wants. Or she might be very unassertive or laid back. Cooperation, on the other hand, is a person's willingness to satisfy the concerns and needs of the other people involved in the conflict who are pursuing their own desired outcome. So in any given conflict situation, a person might be very cooperative or outright uncooperative in the engagement. First, let me say that there's no one absolute best style and that the situation you find yourself in can and should play a major role in your strategy for conflict resolution. Secondly, you will probably want to take into account the identity of the parties when deciding which approach you choose for resolving it. You might handle conflict involving a friend very differently than you would handle conflict involving your boss or a coworker. And finally, most of us have a dominant or preferred style that we use when approaching conflict. That preference can limit our effectiveness if we're unwilling to learn how to use other styles that might be appropriate for a given situation. The Thomas Kuhlman Conflict Resolution Model provides us with a better understanding of the interaction of assertiveness and cooperation in the various possible approaches to conflict resolution. The model identifies five basic resolution styles: competition, accommodation, avoidance, compromise, and collaboration. The competition or forcing approach is high on assertiveness and low on being cooperative. With this strategy, a person in a conflict pursues his or her own concerns in a fairly aggressive fashion, and often does so at the expense of the other people involved in the conflict. This is a power-oriented strategy where it becomes all about one party wanting to win and satisfying his or her needs without considering the position of others involved in the conflict. Such a person is willing to use rank, position power, status, coercive power, and the power of persuasion to win the day. This approach is also frequently described as a win-lose approach to the conflict. Now, in contrast, accommodation is a style where a person is unassertive and willing to be highly cooperative. And this strategy is the polar opposite of the competition strategy. In an accommodation strategy, individuals give lower priority to their own needs and concerns to satisfy the needs and concerns of the other party. An accommodating strategy means giving in to another person's position, obeying another person's order, even when we would rather not do so, or surrendering your position to another point of view. Some people call this the rolling over strategy. People using this approach may be doing so because they're hopeful that the problem or conflict will go away in time, or their cooperation can be viewed as a self-sacrifice in the process. An accommodator will try to reduce tension and stress by giving in or obliging others at his or her own expense. But individuals using the style have still unmet needs that frequently bubble up at a later point in time. So here's the warning. If you're an accommodator, you're frequently surrendering your voice and letting other people have their way in the short run. But know that over time, with unmet needs and ideas that are not being listened to, it will have a degrading effect on your performance, your job satisfaction, your attitude, among other things, which is never a good thing. Now, an avoidance strategy means that a person is both unassertive and uncooperative when it comes to attempting to resolve a conflict. In an avoidance strategy, a person frequently sticks his or her head into the sand. They delay involvement, they sidestep an issue, or they simply withdraw altogether from the discussion or the circumstances. The avoidance approach suggests that a person shuns conflict at all cost and is willing to ignore or disengage from an issue regardless of its importance. And when a number of people in any work group or team take this approach, lethargy, mediocrity, complacency, and poor performance are not far behind. The warning attached to this avoidance strategy goes back to the simple fact that most problems, conflicts, and crises do not go away without action. When people just walk away from these situations, a whole different set of conflicts and problems will follow. Okay, a compromising strategy takes a middle or moderate position on both the issues of assertiveness and cooperativeness. When people take a compromising strategy in dealing with conflict, their behavior falls between an accommodating and competing approach. This position is frequently described as a give-and-take approach to resolving a conflict. When people take a compromising approach, it means that they're willing to take steps to find a mutually acceptable solution in an expedient fashion that ensures that some of the other party's needs are being met. At the same time, they're willing to take action to assure some of their own needs are being met as well. This strategy tries to address the root cause of the problem, but it does not fully explore the possibility of finding a win-win solution for both parties. In certain conflict situations, the strategy might just mean seeking a middle-of-the-road position or splitting the difference on a particular issue, which may provide an acceptable solution. But the warning here, especially in the case of a substantive business conflict, is that a compromise solution to a problem might not be a real solution at all. It just may put off all the underlying conflict for another day. Lastly, there's the collaboration strategy, which makes a tremendous amount of sense in most business scenarios. Collaborators work very hard to be both assertive in representing their own needs and cooperative in being sensitive and understanding to the needs of others. This strategy takes a more serious problem-solving approach and try to resolve a conflict and find a win-win solution. When people are collaborating to resolve a conflict, they explore the actual disagreement to solicit insight from each other. They're willing to put themselves in each other's position to achieve better understanding. And this means that both parties are actively engaged and work together to clearly define the problem and generate effective and mutually acceptable alternatives to solve it. They work together to find meaningful and creative solutions. Clearly, if you're trying to resolve a conflict between others, this is your ideal scenario. A collaboration strategy is really a team-based problem-solving effort that can produce a superior outcome when both parties are cooperative, assertive, and willing to work together. The real benefit of the Thomas Kilman conflict resolution model is that you can use its five approaches to analyze any workplace conflict and then decide how to best respond to it. The next time a workplace conflict occurs, start by determining whether it's substantive or emotional and at what level the conflict is taking place, intergroup, intragroup, or interpersonal. Then determine the level of cooperativeness and assertiveness of the parties involved. You can use the five strategies we've just discussed to determine how you will approach this conflict. You can also use the model proactively to assess your own work environment. When you look at all of your working relationships, ask yourself how you approach disagreements and conflict when it pops up. Is there a conflict that's getting in the way of the performance that you're avoiding or an issue that needs to be addressed? Is there a conflict at work where you've been accommodating, but the situation is still unresolved or maybe even getting worse? Do you have a situation where you forced a solution to a conflict without taking into account the needs of the other party? Is the solution working as you demanded? Do you have a conflict where you have compromised a solution that really didn't work or turn out to be a solution at all? If so, do you need to revisit it? And finally, do you make collaboration a major component of your approach to resolving workplace disagreements and conflict? And if not, why not? Always remember that conflict can be managed, and it's always better to address sooner rather than later. In the words of World War II Admiral William Halsey, all problems become smaller if you don't dodge them, but confront them. Thanks so much. Listen, learn, and lead well.
This lecture is titled Ethics and the Bathsheba Syndrome.
The company names have become synonymous with scandal. Enron, Tyco International, Arthur Anderson, Global Crossing, Adelphi Communications, Bear Stearns. In each of these cases, corporate leaders created company cultures that were driven by exceptionally unethical behavior and produced devastating consequences. The bad behavior continues. In any major business publication, it's common to see salacious and eye-popping headlines such as CEO busted for insider trading, or accounting firm caught cooking the books, or government officials falsify key performance data, or whistleblowers blow open banking scandal. What the heck is going on? Where have all the good leaders gone? Whatever happened to good old-fashioned business ethics? Business school discussions of ethics have a way of getting abstract and philosophical in a hurry. Before you know it, your head is swimming with talk of utilitarianism and the deontology of Immanuel Kant and the justice theory of John Rawls and the virtue ethics of Aristotle. But don't get me wrong. All of these schools of thought have a great deal to say about how to make effective and ethical decisions. But for purposes of this discussion on ethical decision making, I want to try to be very focused and practical. Because what I think current and future business leaders really need today when it comes to ethics is clear guidance. The bottom line is always on every business leader's mind, so let me speak to this first. I want to make a strong case that good ethics are good for your business and for your career. There's a well-established link between an organization's ethical behavior and its financial performance. Yes, its financial performance. While there might be some short-term financial gain to be had by cheating, over the long run, ethical behavior delivers better financials. Secondly, having a reputation as an ethically responsible enterprise makes it easier to retain and attract customers, as most people want to do business with an organization that they can trust and believe in. Thirdly, organizations that create ethical and trusting cultures have higher levels of teamwork and more effective communications. This makes it easier and faster to drive organizational change and transformation, which can be a real competitive advantage in most industries. And finally, in the current talent wars, organizations that act socially and in ethically responsible ways have a leg up on attracting and retaining top talent. People want to work for organizations that they believe in and can be proud of. I could go on. But the truth of the matter is that this is just a short list of some of the empirically based benefits that organizations reap when their leaders and employees choose to take the high road. And when you look at the organizations that frequently show up on the list of America's most ethical companies, companies like Marriott, Kellogg, Cisco Systems, Ford Motor Company, UPS, 3M, and Time Warner, you can't help but notice that they're all doing the right thing, but they're also great places to work, and they're very profitable, high-performance operations. Now, is that to say that these organizations don't have ethical challenges? Well, of course not. Every organization that employs people will always have ethical issues and challenges. But these organizations have senior leaders who place a high value on setting high ethical standards and developing organizational practices and policies that select, promote, and reward ethical behavior. And conversely, when organizations and their leaders do not set high ethical standards, it can spell real trouble. The reason you need ethical standards and policies, of course, is that people and organizations are fallible. Even with the best of intentions, they can sometimes drift into behavior that, well, when viewed dispassionately, can be identified as simply wrong. And it's easier for that to happen than you just might think. Let's look at some examples. Let's say your business is in urgent need of waste removal. You solicit bids from a number of service providers, all of which are very competitive. But the low bid comes from an organization that has just been fined for illegally dumping. So what do you do with this company? Will you do business with them since they're the low bidder? You might say, of course, well, yeah, they're the low bidder. Or you just might say no, as you don't want to do business with an organization that has been socially irresponsible. The problem is that your business isn't doing very well, though, and you've been wrestling with your conscience about whether or not to lay off long-standing employees, including some good, loyal people who have elderly parents and young children to support. So you really need to save the money. Well, here's the question. What should you do? In another scenario, after a lengthy recruiting process, you have two final candidates for a critically important sales position. One candidate is a decent performer with a steady track record of securing business with solid, moderate growth each and every year. But the second candidate is a super salesperson who has the potential to bring in off-the-chart sales. But well-founded rumors have it that he's a womanizer, and they followed him throughout his career. You have a new product that you think is going to be a real help to millions of people, but unless its sales are fantastic, the future of your company may be in doubt. So which candidate would you pick? Okay, here's a third situation. You're an HR professional, and you have access to information concerning an upcoming downsizing. A close friend and confidant of yours is scheduled to lose his position in the next month, and yet you know that he and his wife have just put an offer in on a new home and that they had to stretch to afford it. Your boss has sworn you to secrecy to not share a word of this downsizing with anyone, and the company rules also forbid it. So what would you do? What would you do in each of these scenarios? Does the right course of action seem obvious to you? Can you see how someone could talk himself into doing the wrong thing for the right reasons? In these kind of situations, people need standards to follow in order to make good choices. And that's why it's imperative that we carefully consider and understand our own values, the circumstances and manner in which we make decisions, and the legal and ethical rules and policies that our organizations follow. The starting point for ethical decision-making is our moral values. That is, our fundamental beliefs concerning what is good or bad, right or wrong, acceptable or unacceptable. Our moral values are molded to a great extent by our religious beliefs and training, and the influence of our families and an environment, and especially during our developmental years. While moral values can vary greatly, people share a lot of common ground in this area. For example, most of us believe it's wrong to steal, murder, and do harm to innocent people. Now, our moral values are critically important because they become the basis of our personal ethics, which are standards or codes of conduct that guide our decision-making and behavior. Stated differently, our ethics represent our personal beliefs about whether an action or decision is right or wrong. So your personal ethics might include such things as your stance on truthfulness in dealing with others, honesty in lying, adhering to a code of conduct, the use of confidential information, and whether it's okay to use alcohol or drugs, among many other things. Our ethics are critically important as they impact the decision-making and cognitive processes that govern the choices we make in both our personal and professional lives. And the decisions we make strongly influence our behavior and our action. So what are your own values? What do you believe is right and the right way to live and behave towards other people? What you need to do is to get clear on your beliefs and create a moral awareness in yourself when approaching any decision-making situation. The goal is to develop the ability to spot any ethical issues that might be present. When ethical issues are at play, the first thing you need to do is stop and think. Then garner relevant information and facts so that you're working hard to fully understand both the situation and context of that decision to be made. For example, what did that low-bid waste removal company do that resulted in a fine? Did it change its behavior or its leaders in the wake of the incident? What about the job candidate with a reputation for womanizing? What are the accusations against him? And what does he have to say for himself? Without clear information, it will be hard to reach a good decision. Next, make a list for yourself of the options that are open to you in your decision. Is there really no alternative other than a questionable choice? Have you considered every possible course of action? Then you need to clearly identify the legal and ethical implications of each course of action in your decision-making alternatives. This requires that you consider all the stakeholders that are impacted by each alternative and the consequences of those different options. You also need to make sure that you will consider the law of unintended consequences in your deliberation. What if your decision doesn't turn out as planned? So it's really important to ask the following questions when making decisions. Is this decision legal? Is this decision in line with my organization's values? Is this decision in line with my own values? How will this decision impact the stakeholders? What is the upside of this decision? What is the downside of this decision? Bear in mind that the answer to an ethical dilemma might already have been made for you. If you look at your organization's code of conduct, union contract, or policy manual, you may well find that some decisions have already been pre-programmed. So it's important that you know and understand these important organizational documents. Next, seek wise counsel and the input of knowledgeable and experienced people whom you trust when making decisions involving ethical issues. There is no substitute for getting a second set of eyes to test your thinking and your approach in making decisions with serious ethical consequences. To make these types of decisions alone and in isolation is to invite trouble. Finally, when making decisions with ethical implications, ask yourself, what would our board of directors or my mom have to say about this decision when they find out? Does this decision give you a bad feeling in your gut? Well, pay attention to your instincts. Note that there's nothing magical about these guidelines. The key here is to simply get you to think before you make an important decision. Because that simple act can make a world of difference and spare you some major league regrets and griefs later on. Now, it's at this point in a discussion on business ethics that many people mentally check out. They say to themselves, okay, I've got it. I know what to do, and I know that I'll never fall victim to temptation in a business decision-making situation. But stop for a moment and think again about how often you see people in the news who've been caught behaving unethically. And consider how often you hear them say, I don't know what I was thinking. The fact is that thinking your way through an ethical dilemma isn't always easy, and the temptation to cross the line can be surprisingly strong. I've worked with many different organizations, and I believe that as a general rule, they work very hard to hire good and principled people. They usually have multi-step selection processes designed to hire people with both competency and character. They do background checks, and they do drug screenings. And organizations develop codes of conduct, and they conduct ethical training to establish and communicate ethical standards. Organizations also frequently provide a number of vehicles for employees to report on corporate and leadership wrongdoing. And they work hard to reward appropriate behavior and to encourage and promote social responsibility. I also believe that most people who work in organizational America are basically good and principled people. But here's the unsettling part. The fact remains that any one of us could get caught up in doing wrongful, unethical, immoral, and even illegal things if we are not vigilant. I base this broad and bold statement on what I have come to call the Bathsheba syndrome, which has been a big part of my research for the past 2 decades, as I and my colleagues try to figure out what causes good and successful people to do wrongful things at work. To understand this principle, we must go back to antiquity and take a quick look into the life of Israel's King David. David is an important figure to members of the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic faiths. As you may know, David had early success as the slayer of the Philistine giant Goliath, and he went on to become a powerful king of Israel. He was a warrior, entrepreneur, visionary, poet, musician, strategist, and charismatic leader with a career of exceptional, principled, and faith-based behavior. He was popular among his people. He controlled vast resources and territories, and the nation of Israel was at the pinnacle of its success and prosperity in ancient times under his leadership. Now for the bad part. The Bible tells us in 2 Samuel chapter 11 that in the spring, when kings go off to war, David chose to stay in Jerusalem. One evening he could not sleep. And as he looked down from the palace to the city below, he saw a beautiful woman bathing on her rooftop. He sent a servant to inquire who this woman was, and the servant reported that her name was Bathsheba. She was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, one of David's key soldiers who was off in battle. Upon hearing this report, David sent several servants to bring Bathsheba to the palace. And it is here where David made an unethical decision to commit adultery that would cost him dearly. Bathsheba became pregnant, and upon learning that fact, David ordered Uriah to return to Jerusalem under the pretense of providing him with a war update. In an effort to cover up his extramarital affair, David then ordered Uriah to go to his home and spend time with his wife. Uriah refused to do so, demonstrating great character. He told the king that if his soldiers could not have the comfort of sleeping in their bed and being with their wives, then neither could he as their leader. Wow! What a principled leader indeed. David took another run at Uriah the next day after getting him drunk, but Uriah again refused to visit and return to his home. So the next day, David had Uriah return to the front, carrying a note to his general, Joab. Well, unbeknownst to Uriah, the note ordered Joab to send Uriah into battle where he could be killed. Joab followed this order, and by design, Uriah was killed, implementing an ill-conceived attack that resulted in the deaths of a number of soldiers as well. Joab then sent a note to David stating that Uriah was dead. David's callous response to Joab read, "Do not worry, as these things happen in war." Then after a couple months of mourning, David took Bathsheba as his wife. It looked as if David would get away with his wrongdoing until a whistleblower by the name of Nathan came forward and called David out. And then a series of troubling events rocked both King David's personal world as well as his kingdom. Now you might say, Clint, what does this have to do with me? I'm not a king and I don't have a palace. But let me point out a couple of important things about David's fall that are quite instructive for all of us. First, David took his eye off his job and he made it about himself. He should have been at the front with his army, not living a comfortable life at the palace. Never forget what your job is, who is paying you to do it, and why. Secondly, David's position as king exposed him to this temptation and enabled him to act on his temptation in a way that otherwise would not have been available to him. It was easy for him to give in to temptation, and for whatever reason, good King David did not succeed in resisting it. Instead, he made a very, very poor decision. Every position we hold over the course of our careers will bring with it specific temptations. We need to handle them appropriately if we are to avoid ethical failure. And finally, David mistakenly believed that he had the power to cover up his wrongdoing, just like the executives believed at Enron, Global Crossing, and Bear Stearns. Most people who get caught up in unethical decisions hold this mistaken belief. If they understood that they were more likely to get caught and their careers, their reputations, and their families might be destroyed as a result, there's a good chance that they might not have engaged in unethical behavior. And it's worth adding that even those who don't get caught often find their lives ruined in other ways, whether it's through guilt or simply as a result of losing their moral compass. I call this phenomena the Bathsheba syndrome, because we all have Bathshebas, or temptations that we must handle if we are to remain ethical and principled leaders and professionals. To avoid falling victim to ethical temptations, it's imperative that we do more than just think about our values and establish decision-making processes. On a very deep level, we need to know and understand ourselves and the temptations we face at work and beyond. And then we need to organize our lives to protect ourselves from those temptations. Over the past few years, I've been asked by a number of organizations, including the United States military, to help them develop specific practices designed to prevent ethical failure among their leaders and employees. Here are some very practical guidelines that emerge from our focus group research. I'm going to share them, as these are actions that we can all take on our own behalf for our own sake, but also we can do them collectively as a team or as a department. To start, it's really important to develop a list of the various ethical temptations that you face in your current work position. I call this temptation mapping, which means taking the time to specifically identify the Bathshebas that confront us in our current position. Now, temptation can be defined as a desire for something bad or unacceptable, a desire or craving for something, especially something considered to be wrong. What makes something bad or unacceptable, you might ask? Well, if it violates company codes of conduct and policy, professional standards, or laws, that's a pretty good indication, don't you think? Our temptation mapping exercises with business leaders consistently uncover common workplace temptations that include falsifying data, abusing an expense account or corporate credit card, inappropriate sexual relationships, stealing, offering or accepting bribes or kickbacks, manipulation of hiring decisions, and we're just getting started. The goal of temptation mapping is to proactively identify the things that can destroy you if you give in to that temptation. And remember, the higher you rise in your organization, the more temptation you will face. And once you know now what you're up against, it's time to develop your situational awareness. The purpose of this step is to avoid putting yourself in circumstances where you will be exposed to harmful temptations and prone to act on them. If King David had better situational awareness regarding his temptations, he might not have stayed in the palace while his army was off at war. And certainly he wouldn't have invited Bathsheba to stop by for a visit. Know your personal strengths and weaknesses, and whenever possible, stay away from situations and people that might cause you to stumble. Developing your situational awareness will enable you to take the next step. Create a personalized code of conduct. Now, I know that most organizations have corporate codes of conduct, but our research shows that each one of us needs to personalize and own our own code of conduct, given the particular ethical temptations that we face. So maybe your personal code of conduct states that you never handle petty cash alone, or you never meet with a contractor without another person being in the room. Maybe it requires that you don't consume alcohol at all, or never more than one drink when doing business, or that you will not travel alone with a member of the opposite sex. Whatever your personal code of conduct looks like, make it yours. Study it and commit it to memory. And review and update it every time you take on a new position, because there's a good chance that any new position will present new temptations and new challenges. Here's another really important guideline. Make yourself accountable. We found that to adhere to an ethical code of conduct is critically important to foster both personal and professional accountability with a person or persons strong and honest enough to be your mentor, friend, and watchdog. It's interesting to note that many people, and especially senior leaders, get caught up in wrongdoing at a time in their lives or careers when they're experiencing a sense of isolation and a lack of real friends whom they can count on. So here is great advice. When confronted with an ethical trial or dilemma, immediately tell a confidant whom you trust. I can demonstrate the value of this guideline with an example from my own work. I recently received a phone call from a young former MBA student of mine whose boss had just asked him to do something that he knew was unethical. He had just started with a large manufacturing organization as a sales leader, and he received a customer order for 5 very expensive pieces of equipment. He took the order to his boss, and after reviewing it, the boss said, "Well, just go ahead and place their order for 6 units. They're not real good at tracking these things, and they'll end up needing an additional unit at some point down the road anyways. We do this all the time." My former student now was worried about being fired if he didn't comply. Fortunately, he immediately called me as a mentor to get my input. We discussed the situation, and we quickly concluded that the best solution was for my former student to ask his boss to put his request in writing. And guess what? His boss immediately responded, "Never mind." Because all of a sudden, the boss realized that it would be his neck on the line, not somebody else's, if anyone raised a question about the order that he wanted my former student to place. But without having another person as a sounding board, my former student just might not have had the confidence at such an early stage of his career to stick by what he knew was right. Another important way of protecting yourself from the temptations that are out there is to keep your financial, your physical, and your emotional house in order. Doing so will make you much less susceptible to the lures of greed, jealousy, addiction, or lust. In the words of one ethics professor, ethical failures are usually attached to 3 things: wallets, bottles, and zippers. So living within our means, avoiding addictive substances, and taking great care to protect and maintain and grow our critically important relationships is paramount, not only to our continued professional success, but more importantly, to the things in life that really, really count. Here's another tip. Be aware of the trap of being emotionally expansive. A good psychologist will tell you that people are emotionally expansive when they feel that whatever they have is never good enough. They always want more of everything without appreciating what they already have. We can all relate to this to some degree. On any given day, we may wish we had a new car, a promotion, a better home, or whatever. But if we live this way, we are destined to be in a constant state of frustration over what we don't have instead of being thankful and appreciative for what we do have. David took Bathsheba even though he already had 7 wives. So it's important to develop an attitude that allows us to spend sufficient time being thankful for what we do have. And in doing so, we increase the likelihood of not getting caught up in temptations. Finally, when making a decision about whether to do something that we might consider to be in a gray area or questionable or maybe even flat out wrong, ask yourself this critically important question. What are the long-term consequences of this decision to my character, profession, career, and family when others find out about my actions? Because the odds are they will eventually find out. In one of our studies, we asked a group of senior leaders to identify a leader that they had personally worked with, someone that they respected, whom they knew had engaged in an unethical act in the workplace. Of the people they identified, over 80% of those leaders were eventually found out and experienced negative consequences because of their actions. In the information age, secrets are hard to keep, and the likelihood of getting caught is great. I hope you'll be wise enough to behave ethically because it's the right thing to do. But if for no other reason, avoid unethical behavior because in the long run, you're unlikely to get away with it. To close out this discussion, I would like to share a thought-provoking quotation with you about the importance of ethical decision-making. It's not from a lawyer, a priest, a rabbi, or a pastor, or from Oprah or Dr. Phil, although it could be. This quote is from a CFO of a Fortune 1000 service organization, and it captures the essence of the ethical challenges we all face. Here goes. All of us need to be reminded on a regular basis that a leader's reputation and lifetime of work can be destroyed in an instant by making unethical or immoral decisions in the workplace. It's imperative to guard your heart from going down the dark paths that confront all of us. So as you make your decisions at work and life on a daily basis, this is really important, guard your heart. So listen, learn, and lead well.
This lecture is titled, Leading Real Organizational Change.
What if your doctor told you that you had to make serious lifestyle changes immediately or that you were going to die prematurely? What if your doctor backed up his warning with a host of facts about your condition that clearly supported his gloomy prognosis? Would you? Could you make the necessary changes that he recommended? Remarkably, many people who are faced with that situation don't. And many organizations faced with threats that are equally grave behave exactly the same way. They just keep doing what they've been doing and hoping that their problems will somehow go away. But change within an organization is unavoidable and it's essential. So anyone who holds a leadership position in an organization or hopes to hold one someday absolutely must learn how to get its people to change the way they do things. In this lecture, I'm going to share with you some research and ideas about organizational change that will help you make it happen. It's often said that the only constant in modern organizations is change. And most of us have experienced the disruptive, unsettling effects of change in our workplace. So it's common to wonder, why do we have to keep making changes? And why do we have to do it so often? Today, organizational change is driven by all kinds of factors. New growth strategies, international expansions, business downturns, mergers and acquisitions, retrenchment strategies, and the like. These strategic choices and events can quickly require a wide variety of changes, such as major restructuring, workforce reductions, new reporting relationships, and the opening and closing of facilities, more aggressive goal setting, and cost containment initiatives. Technological advances are also a tremendous driver of change, as new, speedy technologies make even new, speedier technologies possible, companies need to reorganize themselves constantly to react or take advantage of new opportunities. And as soon as your company changes, its competitors will adapt in order to keep up with it, which will force your company to change yet again. And the cycle never stops. So essentially, today's business environment is relentlessly dynamic, and that requires each of our organizations to constantly realign their strategies and their structures to be successful. Okay, if change is so important, what makes achieving it within an organization so difficult? In the words of Dr. John Kotter of the Harvard Business School, evidence is overwhelming that the central challenge of change is not strategy or systems or culture. The fundamental problem is changing the behavior of people. Now, Dr. Kotter makes this observation as one of the world's foremost authorities on change after four decades of researching organizational transformation. So he makes it pretty clear that to have organizational change, changing people's individual behavior is absolutely needed. And yet, the fact is that people and organizations often resist change, and that resistance has many causes and can take many forms. As we all know, change can bring with it great economic insecurity, causing people to worry about losing their jobs and livelihoods. We don't want to change because we're afraid of what it means to us economically. And other fears emerge as well. Fear of the unknown, fear of failure, fear of becoming obsolete, fear of losing power and control and workplace friends. In the face of these fears, it's a natural impulse to want to keep things as they are and defend the status quo. Oh, and by the way, change activities in an organization typically take place on top of our already hectic work schedules, providing an added source of stress. Who wants to change in light of all that? To make matters even worse, people within an organization are not always told why changes are necessary or given the opportunity to ask questions so that they can understand how the change process will work. And they may not have a lot of confidence or trust in their leaders to begin with as a result of failed change efforts in the past. So lacking a good reason and uncertain of the outcome, they naturally are less than eager to disrupt their lives. To illustrate this point, a mid-sized service organization recently implemented a new compensation system which was received with great resistance and angst by employees who were both skeptical and cynical of the organization's motives for doing so. And this company had a track record of not engaging their workforce in implementing some pretty ineffective and poorly planned change initiatives in the past. The goal of the new compensation system was actually to increase employee wages. They wanted to make the company more attractive in the recruiting process and more capable of retaining employees who were being poached by competitors by paying higher wages. The company wanted to put more money in the pockets of their employees, and yet they failed to put a credible leader in charge and take the time to fully explain why they were doing it. In addition, they didn't explain to their employees how the new system would operate, and they didn't answer their questions prior to the rollout. The rollout stirred up a hornet's nest of complaints and unproductive behavior until people figured out after a couple pay cycles that the new compensation system was a good thing. It sounds pretty crazy to say it, but people were actually resisting the opportunity to make more money because of past practice and how the change was presented to the workforce. Employees aren't the only source of resistance to change, however. Interestingly, the leadership of an organization can be just as reluctant to adapt. In 1963, Harvard historian Dr. Alfred DuPont Chandler wrote an outstanding book entitled Strategy and Structure. Chandler traced the factors that drove historical changes in some of the very largest U.S. organizations, and he discovered a key principle that was surprising back in the day. He found that businesses were not as proactive as people believed, but rather tended to be highly reactive. They changed only when they were forced to take action because of failing performance. More specifically, Chandler found that businesses took action only when they were confronted with the harsh reality that their current strategies for doing business were no longer working in a changing marketplace. In a nutshell, Chandler found that organizational leaders tended to allow the status quo to rule until things got pretty bad and they were forced to change out of necessity. While this behavior may be understandable, it's a terrible abdication of responsibility. First of all, a business that only reacts to change rather than driving it proactively is unlikely to ever realize its full potential. But more importantly for this discussion, meaningful change in any organization requires effective leadership, whether it's strategic, tactical, or operational change. In a study that I'll describe in greater detail in a couple minutes, two colleagues of mine and I found that the single most important factor for successful change in any organization, regardless of the organization, is leadership. Effective and trustworthy leadership. That's why it's so important that you acquire the right leadership skills to bring change about. So let's take a closer look at the essential ingredients of organizational change. When change is needed, many organizational leaders reach for a formal improvement process. They are very popular these days, and there's lots of them, and you may be familiar with some of them. Lean thinking, Six Sigma, Ford's quality operating systems, Kaizen, total quality management, or reengineering, just to name a few. Now, other leaders use some less formal methods, which can give into aggression and even be confrontational in nature. They send out forceful, demanding emails. They give passionate, burning platform pep talks. They engage in screaming or fist-pounding or fear-mongering, or issue mandates from on high that go something like this, now go and do. All of these methods are capable of creating a flurry of activity, but unless they're applied in an effective and perceptive way, they're unlikely to produce desired and sustainable change, or what I like to call real change. In fact, it's been estimated that only around 20% of all organizational change initiatives achieve their desired outcomes, which is a pretty sobering thought. That means 80% of the time, instead of changing, leaders who are trying to achieve change are actually wasting time, frustrating people, losing credibility, and burning precious organizational resources. And there's some interesting research that suggests a lot of traditional approaches to change are woefully inadequate if an organization is serious about change and changing fast. To be more productive, let's go back to the question I posed at the start of this lecture. What if your doctor told you that you had to immediately make serious lifestyle changes or that you were going to die prematurely? Could you change? Would you change? As a reporter for Fast Company magazine, Alan Deutschman attended a healthcare conference when he learned that the overwhelming majority of U.S. healthcare dollars are expended on medical conditions that are caused by people's lifestyle choices. Things like smoking, drinking, overeating, too much stress, and too little exercise were identified as destroying the health of a disproportionate number of Americans. And despite dire and even graphic warnings of the consequences, our population continues trending in the wrong direction. Deutschman learned that when cardiologists told their coronary bypass patients that they needed to change their diets, stop smoking, get regular exercise, control alcohol consumption, and work to reduce stress to avoid a second surgery, only 1 out of 9 patients, or 11%, were able to make the necessary lifestyle changes. He chronicled these and other research findings in a book entitled Change or Die, and found that facts, fear, and force alone don't drive real and sustainable change in people's lives. And this bears repeating. Facts, fear, and force alone do not cause real change to happen in people's lives, or in organizations for that matter. What Deutschman did find was that for people to change, they had to overcome inertia, old habits, and previously failed efforts. And he introduced 3 dynamics that must be in place for real change to take place. He called them the 3 R's. Relate, repeat, and reframe. And I think that they're as valid for an organization as they are for individuals who are managing their own health. According to Deutschman, if we are to change, we must have a strong relationship with someone that will come alongside of us to inspire us and give us hope that the change we need to make is possible. He found that we all need a trusted soul to continuously remind us that we are capable of making the change and to provide us with accountability and encouragement. To really change, we need someone who can relate to us during the change process. That person needs to be someone we trust, who can help us get focused and stay focused on what we're trying to accomplish. And that person will even be more valuable if he or she can provide us with a well-conceived strategy or game plan to make the change actually happen. You see, we all need an action plan that we can believe in, that we can own and understand. So in the case of organizational change, having a leader that we can trust, who has both the character and competency that can help us forge a real plan for action, can be the difference between success and failure. Now, for real change to happen, according to Deutschman, we also need to repeat. With direction from the person who is guiding us through the change, we need to learn, practice, and master the activities and actions that will allow the change that we are actually trying to make to come to fruition. Real change requires new skills and habits, and to acquire these things requires training, coaching, feedback, and accountability. When we acquire the needed talent to support change, we need to repeat and repeat and repeat those actions. And we need to do this until they become habits. And when we're trying to change, we need to acquire the specific skills that drive change, and then we need coaching and feedback to reinforce the change so that we can repeat those behaviors until they become part of our work lifestyles and what we all like to call habits. So people leading us through the change process need to be great teachers and coaches. But think of how often we simply throw people into organizational change initiatives with little, if any, preparation and virtually no focus on their talent and skill development. For any change process to work, people need the skills and talents necessary to support the change. Deutschman's final R is to reframe. And by this he means that the person helping us through the change must help us form a new way of thinking about and understanding our situation and the change behaviors that we're currently engaging in. Reframing is needed to help people move from thinking and saying, I hate this change, or why do we have to do this again, to this change is going to put us in a better position, or the benefits of this change are really needed. Reframing in the context of organizational change is critically important to help people understand why changes are needed and necessary, and to adapt their thinking to support these efforts. If the company rolling out the new compensation system would have taken the time to help their employees reframe the change, it could have been better received without any of the resistance and negative fallout that emerged. Deutschman found that when these three principles, relate, repeat, and reframe, were applied to coronary bypass patients in a controlled research study, the success rate for making the necessary and major healthy lifestyle changes jumped from 11% to an astounding 78%. Now, Deutschman's approach takes more time and effort and energy, but in the end, the change is real and sustainable, which should be the goal of each and every organizational and individual change effort we engage in. So to summarize, facts, force, and fear don't do a lot to drive real, healthy, and sustainable change. But relating, repeating, and reframing do. Okay, now we've got the basic ingredients of change in place. But what kind of leadership is required to make it happen? And what practical steps can you take to achieve change in your organization? Well, for the past two decades, we've been studying organizational change and improvement initiatives in virtually every sector of the U.S. economy. In our book, The 2-Minute Drill, my friends Greg Papp and Tim Stansfield and I analyzed over 1,000 successful and unsuccessful change initiatives, and we found some very interesting patterns. In this research study, the people who were participating were a cross-section of executives, middle managers, and frontline supervisors. We asked them all to identify both a successful and unsuccessful change initiative that they had been part of during their careers. Participants were interviewed to share and describe these experiences, and they were asked to provide detailed written instructions on what specifically led to success and failure in each of these experiences. The interview transcripts and written data used to describe each of these case studies were then content analyzed and became the basis for our research findings.